license fee, which it won't be on the entire marriage license fee. There's two levels of marriage licenses in this state. One where you get 12 hours of pre-marriage education, where you can buy the license for $40, or if you don't, it costs $110. We're going to be raising that to $115 to pay for this. And we've had a similar program in place for the last several years that has provided some of the same similar services to people that are having some issues with their relationships. And it's all been run through the University of Minnesota. Dr. Bill Doherty is with me today. He's a PhD marriage and family therapist, professor at the University of Minnesota. He's written about 10, 12 books on the subjects of marriage and divorce, and has been very successful in many projects he's had throughout his life. And he's been one of my advisors on some of these issues over the last several years. And I'd like to have him give you a rundown on what he has in mind for this this program. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Doherty and let him present some further information.
Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. I'll be brief. I know you have a long agenda. Judge Bruce Peterson of the Hennepin County Court was the one who initiated this. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here today. He had a number of cases to hear. He approached me a couple of years ago after his experience of working with so many couples in the divorce court, some of whom he wondered why they were getting along so well, why they were getting a divorce. He pointed out that in the divorce court, the way it's set up now, the assumption is that 100% of the people who file need a divorce to solve their problems, and the goal is to get them through as efficiently as possible. He asked me if there's any research on ambivalence among people who have started the divorce process, and I said no. So we began to gather that data. We now have data on about 2,500 divorcing parents in Hennepin County. And what we find is that about a third of them believe that reconciliation services might be helpful to their relationship and avoid a divorce. And about one out of 10 couples, it's both people who say that. So, and we've also been working with a group of collaborative divorce lawyers. They've been gathering data in their own practices, and they have the same kind of findings, that there's a subset, not the majority, but a subset of people who are seriously considering divorce who could benefit from specialized services that might help them restore their marriage and avoid the divorce. So what we've done at my project at the university, the Couples on the Brink Project, is created some innovative services, coaching services, referral services for couples who find themselves in this situation. You might ask, well, why don't they just go to marriage counseling? Most have tried it, and frankly, a lot of marriage counseling is not sophisticated enough for couples in this situation. So what we're asking for is support for this project, the goal of which is to develop best practices that we would evaluate and disseminate for professionals, clergies, and others around the state for an at-risk population who have fallen off the radar screen, and that is people who have entered or are seriously considering divorce, but who are uncertain about whether that's the best way to solve the problems. The other thing I'll add before stopping is that we have a domestic violence protocol we've developed with the Tubman Family Alliance that involves three levels of screening, because the last thing we want to do is be encouraging a reconciliation among couples who are at high risk. So that's what we're – and finally, we believe that the surcharge and the marriage license fee is an ideal way to provide some modest resources for this, because about 40% of the couples getting married this year in the state will face the prospect of divorce at some time if current data – current trends continue. And this is like an insurance policy, so that adequate services are available for people who need them at the point at which they may be on the brink of divorce. So thank you for considering this.
Madam Chair and members, there was $5 of the marriage license fee that had been used for the last several years for a program called the Minnesota Healthy Marriage and Responsible Fatherhood Initiative, which Dr. Doherty ran. And that program was matched with federal money, 2-to-1. We actually got $1 million from the federal government and $500,000 from the marriage license fee, this $5 fee raises about $100,000 a year. It was a five-year program. And that has been complete, and there's been a report written about it. It was quite successful, and our intention was to take that $5 and continue on with this next program and to fund that. But the $5 was used for this GMAC bill to help fund that. And so that money disappeared here in the last week or so. And so as an alternative, we are suggesting to raise the marriage license fee another $5 to continue funding this important program. Now, there's one other thing that's in this bill I forgot to mention when we started, is that there's an earlier program that Dr. Doherty and I got passed through the system here, is this two-tier marriage license fee if you get 12 hours of pre-marriage education. Last year, the way it works is if the minister, the priest, or whoever is delivering the services, after they get done doing it, they need to sign a statement saying they delivered the services, and then the couple takes that to the courthouse to buy their marriage license for $40 instead of $110. And last year we changed the law to make that statement notarized, or require notarization of the statement, and that's been found to be quite inconvenient for most people doing this, and so I'm repealing that requirement in this bill as well. So it doesn't have to be notarized, just needs to be signed, dated, and use the form that's in the bill here. And you can imagine a lot of these churches, it's not convenient for a pastor to go downtown and find a notary and just an extra step. And I just don't think it's that important. I talked to Senator Betzel about it, who carried the bill last year, and so far he hasn't objected to this.
Senator Dill has an amendment. Senator Coring, would you like to move it
Absolutely.
For him? It's an A2 amendment. It's in your packet. This would insert into the bill for Senator Dill the marriage filing fee that he needs to pay for his program. Is there any discussion of the amendment?
Madam Chair, there's one additional item. I talked to Mr. Giel about it this morning. On line 1.8 of the amendment, it says the lines on page 5, lines 9 to 12, will be deleted. That needs to be changed to lines 4 to 12 will be deleted.
We'll incorporate that into the amendment. Is there any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Now, is there any discussion or any questions about the bill or the program itself? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dillon. We had a lengthy discussion about this in Judiciary. The funding mechanism, though, was the old one that you were describing. So my question is just this. In terms of adding this on to the group you chose to add it on to with regard to the two-tier licensing system,
right.
I understand that we want to incent people to have the counseling, and so maybe that was the rationale for adding it there, making that more expensive so we keep the regular licenses lower. But at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, if somebody goes out and has a 24-hour decision to get married for whatever reason and enters into a marriage that 24 hours later doesn't seem like such a good idea, or even a month later doesn't seem like such a good idea, it would seem to me that it would be less likely that that kind of situation would use the take advantage of the counseling mechanism. And it would also seem that society probably has less of an interest in trying to really promote those two people staying together because there probably aren't children involved and that type of thing. So I would kind of think that the more successful counseling and the more the society's greater interest in really trying to keep marriages together would be more likely directed toward that those couples that took the time initially to go through the counseling process and were really very deliberate about their decision to become married to begin with. Do you think would you disagree with that, or would it still make sense to put it on the other license even if that isn't the group as likely to use it?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Dill.
Senator Olson, you're making an interesting point there. I've always tried to keep it the difference between the two tiers as much as possible, so there's a little more of a financial incentive. It's a small incentive, but it's actually become relatively popular in Minnesota to take the 12 hours. We started out at 22% of the marriages doing the 12 hours of pre-marriage education. Now we're up to 36-37%, so it's a growing practice. And the research shows that if you do that, the program as we have it described in law, the marriage license or the divorce rate is cut by 50% as measured at the 5-year mark, according to some Colorado research. But are you suggesting we take the $5 and apply it against the whole range of both the low marriage license fee and the high one?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
I guess that would be one way of doing it. I guess it just seemed to me that this is probably going to be more likely to be utilized by the other group. But yeah. I don't have really a problem with it either way. Mm-hmm. I just thought that I would bring that up.
Okay. Well, I think Dr. Doherty has an answer for you.
Just, Madam Dr. Chair, there are a lot of people who do not take advantage of the 12 hours, not because they're getting married so quickly or because they don't have access to it in their communities. So I wouldn't want to suggest that that's a not responsible group. I think the case could be made either that it's everybody because everyone is at risk, to continue the incentive that Senator Dill talked about.
Any other discussion? Would you like to move the bill, Senator Coring? Senator Coring will move that Senate file 2383 as amended be recommended. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Is it passed to the floor then, or to where?
To full finance.
To full finance, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next we have Senator Sharon. I'm not sure if she's here yet. Well, I wanted to make sure we can take my bills. Are you ready? We'll start with Senate File 633.
Okay, that's us. Morning.
Good morning, Senator.
I have with me Dr. Amos Steinert, who's a familiar person in the committee, who's here with me today to talk about Senate File on 633, which is the Primary Caries Prevention Services. This is a bill that has passed through this committee, was ready to be passed on the floor of the Senate, and we did not move it forward, so it was re-referred back here to Finance as it was moving through the House. But in the process of moving through the House, some of the language was changed, and so we thought it would be appropriate to bring it back here to make a modification to the language in the Senate. The modification of the language changes one part of the bill in which we change the word from
must to should.
Must to should in terms of carrying out the screening services that are provided. And if there are questions, I would have Dr. Deinert answer them for you.
Well, I think the first thing you need to do is to move your A3 amendment.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, is there discussion of the amendment? And a council indicates you need to change one word in the amendment. Ms. Kavanaugh?
Yeah. Madam Chair, on lines one, I'm sorry, page one, line 26, change the should to must.
No, the other way, change the must, which was in the Senate version last year, to should, which was in the House version last year. When it said must last year, there was a fiscal note attached to it. The House version, by virtue of having the word should, not must, there was no fiscal note.
This is on the information that the provider is to give to the parent just about the need for prevention and the need to find a dental home. And in the discussions with the department, should is fine with being changed to must.
No,
it does not change the fiscal note.
The EPSDT, or the Child and Teen Checkup Guideline from the CMS manual, says the 13th element of the Child and Teen Checkup is that a referral to a dentist is expected. So that should be a should. I mean, Doc should still be doing that. But what the bill, Senator Berglund's bill of last year.
It's a matter of whether it should be a must that the provider
must. Well, I think in terms of referring to a dentist, it should be a must. In terms of putting fluoride varnish on, it should be a should, not a must.
That's not, it must is fine. That's
so
not
I think you want to do this, Senator Sharon.
You do want to do it.
Well, I will accept your recommendation.
So that'll be incorporated into the amendment. Is there any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
God.
Now, this bill has no fiscal note attached to it, so we would be sending it to the full Finance Committee. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, do you want to make your motion, Senator Sharon?
I would like to move Senate File 633 and refer to the floor.
As amended.
To full Finance. As amended.
The motion is that Senate File 633 is amended, be recommended to pass. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. Now we'll take your Senate File 2998.
We're done.
We're done.
Oh, that was quick. So you don't need me. Thank you, Mike.
We can talk later.
And this has to do with a PACE pilot project.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. I have an amendment to this bill as well, the A1 amendment.
And you want to explain the amendment?
The amendment changes the methodology by which we will be funding this program. And if I may, I would have one of our testifiers provide some explanation for the A1 amendment funding mechanism.
Just want to talk about the CSSD?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You want to introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you. My name is Dan Lind with Presbyterian Homes and Services from Arden Hills, Minnesota. And there was 2005 language introducing PACE. But it provided for the provider community paying for the actuarial work and studies or the philanthropic community. And when the provider community aggregated funds to do that, the Attorney General advised us that that was not permissible and anyone that participated would not also be able to participate in the PACE program or the working implementation of it. And so we would like to advance now and advise this advances this to provide funding through the CSSD program. The CSSD is a Community Services Department grant, and it was implemented in 2001 and provides $6 million a year for DHS to help communities, to help people stay in their homes, improve chronic disease management, link formal and informal long-term care services, and promote independence through market-based solutions. We believe PACE addresses all of those goals. We would use a small portion of those funds, which is identified in this bill, $231,000. It's a little less than initial in the amendment because there's a federal match. We would emphasize that once PACE is up and running, there will be no further funding needed because the program would be self-sustaining. And because CSSD provides funding for a competitive grant program, it does not take money from any provider. And it lowers amount available, but not much for grants this year, but not for the future, and does not divert from any other existing programs.
So maybe you can just tell us when this grant ends, how you would be planning to continue the funding for the project. We don't like it when people come here and get these one-time deals and then they come back and say, now we need you to do this again.
Yeah, thank you. Pace, maybe, do you want to say a word about Pace? Go ahead.
Dale, Madam Chair, my name is Dale Thompson, President of Benedictine Health System. We have a number of long-term care campuses in 40 communities across seven states. To directly to your question, I'm not sure that we're the best experts on that, but I think the discussion has been around licensing fees and other types of fees that we charge to PACE providers, as you do with other types of services, nursing home license fees and so on, could be a sustainable part of the ongoing funding. And to your question, that's one point that has been discussed.
And Madam Chair, committee members, if I could add to this, PACE stands for Person-Centered All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, and it's a license type like a care center would be or like a hospital would be. And the purpose of it is to provide services for frail older adults in the community that would otherwise be in care centers. So it's a way of keeping people out of the care centers. It brings in federal monies, and it's like a deeper version of MSHO, so that the program itself is self-funding over time. So what we need is the actuarial funds to get the program authorized, to have the feds set the rate. And once that is established, the license type would, in effect, we believe, reduce the number of people in nursing homes, enhance services in the community, and would be fully self-funding because of the federal kinds of payments and so on that are involved with the reimbursement of the program.
So, Mr. Quinn, you believe that the actuarial work that would be done with the funding you would get through this bill will show that you will have rates that will support the program into the future without any additional funding?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. We believe so. PACE is now in 31 states. It was just nosing past five when this was first introduced in 2005. And to my knowledge, it is self-funding in all the states where it has been implemented and has been successful and had research around it in terms of with results that are consistent with this direction that the state of Minnesota wants to go in terms of reducing institutionalization. On that basis, we do believe that it will be self-funding and a positive benefit to the state.
When you're done with your witnesses, Senator Sharon, I have a question for someone from the department about this grant fund.
Thank you. As a matter of fact, I was going to mention that because we just had a chance to review the fiscal note this morning and discovered that there was some federal money which allowed us to lower the overcost that we're requesting, that the department wanted to speak to that issue and wants to speak to an oral amendment we need to make to the amendment that we just
maybe
passed.
Maybe this would be a good time to have
be a perfect
that.
Time.
Madam Chair, I'm Carrie Erber with the Department of Human Services, and just wanted to kind of walk you through the fiscal note, how it turned out. Basically, it's a transfer from the Community Services Development Fund account into an administrative account for the two FTEs and the actuarial costs. So basically what happens in that case, the money transfers to the admin account at the $256,000 level in 11 and $231,000 in 12. And because it is an admin account, there's actually money that's coming back as FFP. That's why it shows a revenue coming in on the fiscal note of $102,000 and $92,000. We were looking at the possibility. Usually that money goes back to the general fund as a non-dedicated receipt. There were questions whether or not that money could be reinvested back into CSSD to kind of offset some of their costs.
I think that would be a good idea.
And we just need to double-check to make sure that's appropriate, but they do have an oral amendment, and I think it's been done in the past, so I think it'll work, but we'll just have to double-check with a few people because this just came up this morning. So.
Well, maybe you can do that between now and the full finance committee.
Yeah, yep.
The question that I had is if these funds from this account are dedicated to this project, how much will be left for other grantees that would be applying from the community for projects that go through the regular process? How much would be left for them to receive?
Madam Chair, I'm Jean Wood from the Department of Human Services. We estimate about $1.5 million will remain in the account.
Are there any other questions? Maybe somebody can help us with the oral changes to the amendment then.
Would you like me to introduce them to you at this time? We would like to add at the following all of the language under Section 2 appropriation after the period at 1.12, we would add F. Any federal fiscal participation matching funds must be directed to an appropriate Department of Human Services account.
Why do you want to say appropriate account? Why don't you just say the Community Services Development Grant Fund?
That we would accept that. That's a good. That's a good.
Well, I think that would be a lot more.
That's
clear.
A good recommendation. Thank you.
I mean, there are times when money kind of flies around over there. Can you repeat it now for us, Senator Sharon? We need to make sure we're getting
it. Okay, it would be F. We'd add F. Any federal fiscal participation.
Well, you don't need to add F. That's what I understand. Just the wording that you want added.
Okay. Any federal fiscal participation matching funds must be directed to the Community Services Development Grants at the Department of Human Services.
Okay, does everybody understand that now? All right, so we'll add that to the amendment. Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Any other discussion on the bill? Senator Erickson Rolfes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, I think you have a brilliant bill here. And I would, it's a bill, actually, a similar one that I carried the first year I was here and wasn't able to get my grant funding. But I do want to say that southeastern Minnesota, around the Winona area, had been looking at this plan for years. Senator Berglund, you might remember my former senator from that area, and they were trying to move this bill 10 years ago. It was really progressive then. It's probably just still very, very timely. And so I'm really excited to see this move forward, and I hope other regions will be able to jump on board as well.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you very much. I would really want to say to Senator Erickson Robes is a co-author on this bill and has really also been very interested in this approach to care. This has been on our statutes for 5 years, and we just haven't been able to move forward with this opportunity because we weren't able to find a way of helping it get kick-started with money. The initial effort was to try to find some exterior funding, and through extraordinary efforts, even though they were made, they weren't able to find that because people kept referring it back as a responsibility of government. So this has really been a work in progress for a long time, and I'm really pleased that the folks that are here that have been working so hard to bring PACE to Minnesota have found a way to make it work for us.
Well, and good luck to everyone working on it. Any other discussion? Do you want to make your motion then, Senator Sharon?
Yes, I move Senate File 2998 passes as amended and is referred to...
We'll go to the Finance Committee.
To Finance.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you.
we'll take up Senate File 481. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members, I do have an A1 amendment for this bill. Most of this amendment is technical, Madam Chair. What we're trying to do here is to get this bill more focused on the food stamp provisions. It would eliminate, the bill would eliminate the asset limit that we have in our state law for food stamps. And we are able to do this. And this seems like a good time to try to help more families be able to access food stamps because of the economy. More and more middle-class families are out of work and in a position where they need to be able to use food stamps. And yet sometimes the asset limit that we've set in state law, which we really don't need to have there, is a barrier for them. And so this bill is intending to eliminate the food stamp asset limit. The other provisions of the bill related to MFIP have fiscal note costs that probably we won't be able to meet in our division this year. But the food stamp portion is bill that I thought we might be able to do.
Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
I'd like to have some witnesses now, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Berglund, my name is Colleen Moriarty, and I am the Executive Director of Hunger Solutions Minnesota. We have been actively working with communities throughout the state of Minnesota on increasing outreach on the food support or SNAP program. This is a federal benefit that we can bring into our state that is not fully subscribed. In fact, it's quite a ways from it. If it were fully subscribed, it would be an additional $154 million of economic activity that would be available in the state of Minnesota. The benefit helps families at a time when they have been suffering from a loss of income. It's one of the few things, really, we can do to help those families who are in immediate needs in this time when fiscal resources are stretched to such a great demand. This is really a wonderful program because it also stimulates economic growth on Main Street. It brings money into the grocery stores. It brings money into the local communities. And it lessens the reliance on families throughout the state of Minnesota on an emergency food system, which is already straining under the effects of the current economic recession. We are not alone in proposing this kind of activity. There are 26 states that are currently have eliminated the asset test. And just last week, I was in Washington, D.C., and was present during a presentation by Secretary Vilsack of the USDA, and he made remarks about the fact that this was an appropriate thing for states to do along with categorical eligibility. Anything we can do to help families at this time is something I know this body and others are interested in. And asset tests are one of the things that keep people from applying it to the program because of the confusion about it. We do know that the program is very undersubscribed in the senior population, and I think anything we can do to clarify the how people become enrolled in the program and what this means and how they can take advantage of this federal benefit that they've worked hard all their lives have no shame in accepting Social Security or Medicare. And this, again, is another benefit that we can make sure that if seniors are receiving the proper nutrition, their medication will work well, they will be able to stay in their homes longer. In essence, all the nutritional levels of our citizens rise when we attend to the fact that they have the kind of nutrition that they need, and this is a way we can bring that federal benefit to our community. We also have Jim Koppel from the Children's Defense Fund, who's done extensive research on the field of assets and is going to join us in making some comments about this very important subject. Thank you.
Maybe while he's coming up to the table, I can just also mention that in this proposal, we would be raising the income limit from 130% of the federal poverty level to 165% of the federal poverty level. Again, because food stamps are paid for federally, the only cost to this proposal would be some small programming costs.
Mr. Koppel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the director of the Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota, and we're a child advocacy organization working to provide, among other things, economic security for families so that children grow up in stable surroundings. And the report that we did on asset tests basically is broader than just food stamps, but anytime you have an asset test that works against savings, the idea of savings and the incentive to save, it gives low-income working families a mixed message. And so the efforts that we've made from IDAs to savings account encouragement and incentives and other ways is undone when we are telling families to spend down in order to get on a program that they only need temporarily, in most cases, to work through some hardship. So we would love to have asset tests removed, not just because of that, but also because it's the most administratively cumbersome part of an application, both for the client, but also for administrative costs. Anytime you put asset tests in a eligibility criteria, it increases, in the case of healthcare costs, well over doubles the cost of administrative costs to take care of that portion, to investigate it, to make sure that it's being met. So we think administratively as well as programmatically, it's better to not have asset tests. And then finally, by state, Montana, for instance, on the back of the study that we did that was handed out to you, Montana has no asset tests. There are 21 states have no asset tests. 26 states total have taken some form of action, and that's going up every year. That's increasing. These asset tests are barriers to the program, and they are arbitrary. I have my local coffee house where a young woman has saved $25,000 to buy a house. She's ineligible for everything because of asset tests. If she bought a house tomorrow, she would become eligible for every program. So it's just arbitrary where you are in life and what you're trying to do with your life as to whether or not these programs are going to be able to help you. The worst thing she could do would be to spend down all her savings to get on a program and lose her stability or what she would hope to have as her stability in her life. So we need to think long-term of what we want, and certainly this would help. The last piece I'll talk about is the increase in the income limits. That gives families the ability. There's a net income limit for food stamps of 100% of poverty. Your net income has to be under 100% of poverty. That's why the current standard's 130, thinking families can oftentimes have a gross income at 130, but their net would be lower. And that's by going to higher number, it just gives more families the opportunity to meet that lower that standard. It doesn't mean they will. So it isn't opening the floodgates at all. It's just saying to being a little more flexible to allow a little bit higher income families the opportunity to get their net income
to 100% due to unique circumstances they may be in. So I hope that the committee will adopt both provisions, and they certainly will help bring millions of dollars to Minnesota communities. And as the Wall Street Journal stated when we did this whole thing, this was one of the most successful programs getting to Main Street the fastest of any of the stimulus package. So we think more is better.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Koppel or Senator Berglund, could you remind the committee of, in actual dollars, what those income levels are?
I don't think I have that up here. In our budget books, we do have a sheet that tells us that, but I don't know if we have a budget book here.
Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund, for the record, if somebody could reflect that, because it's probably in our folders, yes, but I want to make sure that people who are watching and listening can understand what the limits now are.
Well, so, and just remember, Senator Erickson Ropes, raising one limit doesn't raise the other limit. So, you know, raising this limit would be helpful to people, for instance, who might be farmers, and maybe the wife worked in town and has lost her job, and so, you know, the asset test and the income limit would help a family like that possibly to qualify for food stamps because of the write-offs that they could get in order to get to the net income limit.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, thank you. I think this is a great thing to be doing. I just, maybe council could help us sort through the charts. Could you identify numbers here? So,
Madam Chair and members, the poverty guidelines we have in our packets, it has 150% of poverty and 175% of poverty. And this goes to 165. But the poverty guidelines for a family, for example, of three, 150% of poverty is $27,465. So it would be about $30,000 for a family size of three.
Thank you, Ms. White.
So,
Senator Berglund.
Ms. White, maybe you could remind us for a family of three what 100% is also, because that's what they have to get down to.
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, for a family size of three, 100% of poverty, it's $18,310.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Helpful for people. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Berglund.
It's estimated that this change would help about 2,652 more families either be on the program or stay on the program longer. And the average length of time longer they would be on would be 6 months. So this is a temporary kind of thing that people need to help them through a hard time.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Berglund. And, I can certainly see the side of the rationale where it makes sense when we're in difficult economic times to provide a type of safety net, and it sounds like we'll be getting additional money from the federal government that other states are getting right now to help people get back on their feet and back employed again without putting them at such a low, wiped-out position that they can never come out of the hole. And I think that's the purpose of this bill. And that seems to make good sense. But while we're doing that, and I know I've talked to you about this before, in my district, and I don't know if this is true of people in other places as well, but I know that my House member, one of my House members, has shared this same concern with me. It seems as though if we get complaints about any of our Health and Human Services benefits, this seems to be the program we're hearing the most concern about among people who are not on the program. And I'm guessing it's probably because it's the most visible. You know, it's out there where people are seeing it being used. And the kinds of complaints we are having have to do with people observing things where they feel that the program is being misused for buying things like cigarettes and so forth are cash back. And we talked a bit about the rules of the program and the fact that there might be some misperception simply because now with the use of these cards, there's cash benefits on that card as well as the food benefits, and so people may be confusing the use. But I do think it's important if we're going to be extending the benefit that we really understand what the rules are and that we make sure that the rules are being correctly used by the grocery stores and people who are involved in the process of using these benefits, because I think it's important for the public to understand the rules and also to make sure that the rules are being followed.
I'd like to have Ms. Moriarty speak to this issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Berglund, I think you're absolutely right. There has been some misconceptions about the availability of funds and the use of those funds for the food support program. In essence, you're correct that there are more opportunities for cash rather than just food on some of the cards, and so that may lead people to a misconception. We've been working with the grocers' associations throughout the state to talk about education for the benefits, but the fact of the matter is that to use the food support benefit on things that are not allowable, the card won't accept the transaction. So I think there is a misconception about the program, and we're trying everything we can to stage a long-range campaign in educating people about the benefits of food support. But the benefits of food support to a local community, as far as the availability of proper nutrition, far outweighs the ramifications of anyone's misconception of the program. It really does lend itself well to feeding families and feeding the elderly and feeding children in our communities.
Thank you, Senator
Madam
Berglund.
Chair, people who get cash back on the card are on the MFIP program, and so this bill doesn't change anything about that. This would allow families that are not on the MFIP program perhaps to be able to get food stamps who otherwise are not able to get it. And in those cases, they would not be getting cash back.
I think we'll continue with the testimony at this time. Ms. O'Connell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm with Legal Aid. We have been working on decreasing barriers to participation in the food stamp program for the last 8 years since passage of the Farm Bill in 2002. And so I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to repeat the testimony of Colleen and Jim. I think they've done a great job. But just to say that we do support removing the asset test and see it as a huge barrier for people.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connell. I noted in the material that was provided by the Children's Defense Fund, I think there were some pretty compelling statistics from Oklahoma. It says Oklahoma saved approximately $1.2 million when asset limits were removed from its health care programs, largely as a result of administrative savings. Are there any questions from members of the committee?
Senator Lynch has an amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. I have. I'd like to offer the A2 amendment. And while that's being distributed, maybe I can offer some explanation.
Please go ahead, Senator Lynch.
In my continuing discussions, largely with counties, and in an effort to try to afford them some increased flexibility. One of the areas that we were interested in pursuing was in the area of food stamps distribution. And the amendment simply provides that in current statute, counties have 24 hours in which to
expedite food stamp issuance. The federal law, the time period is 7 days. And what this amendment does is it provides for 1 year the commissioner's prohibited from imposing any corrective action on a county that fails to meet the time frame for expedited food stamp issuance. And in conversations with the counties, I think what this will do is counties certainly want to get those services to those individuals and families that are most in need, but we all know the continued and what will be continuing restraints and restrictions on their resources as well. And so this is just trying to make this not a punitive issue that falls back on the counties. And I, before I take questions, I will just add that in discussions, in preparing this amendment, I had conversations with Hunger Solutions, and I had conversations with Ms. O'Connell from Legal Aid, as well as the department. Council has advised me that there's an oral amendment to the A2 amendment, and members, I would direct your attention to line 1.6. After the word time, after the word the, insert 24 hour. So that it's more clear.
Senator, do you want to process that little change right now, or in with the entire amendment?
Well, I would just, Madam Chair, I'd just ask that we, if the amendment is adopted, that we would incorporate that oral amendment into the A2 amendment.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, as I understand it, it reads, fails to meet the 24-hour time frame.
Senator Berglund, I believe that sounds correct.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, that's correct.
I have no objection to the amendment.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for either Senator Lynch or Senator Berglund. So there is, I'm just asking whether there's any federal strings attached to the money that this would implicate. I'm assuming not.
Doesn't affect any federal funding.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lynch, was this one of the one of the bullet points that the counties came back with and saying this is an issue we worked on that committee. Okay, this was one of the priorities or one of the.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen. I don't recall that this specific issue came forward last year as a part of our work group.
Yeah.
As a follow-up to that this year, counties and other stakeholders provided me with additional ideas and information, and this was an idea in part that came forward from MICA.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Two questions, Senator Lynch. If you do have some additional information that would benefit the work group that came from the counties, that would be greatly appreciated. And number two, has the commissioner done some corrective action in the past? They have opposed some fees or penalties or what?
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there are no fees or monetary penalties associated with the corrective action. As my understanding is that it's more a matter of the reason that this is in statute in the first place was to help ensure and sent that we were in fact expediting these services. So I think that's how we got where we are today. It's a matter of, frankly, I think that the counties and I feel that this is a little bit more punitive, and I don't for a moment think that any county is going to view this and think, we're not going to do everything that we can to expedite these services, but rather it gives them just a little bit of perhaps comfort in knowing that they are, that we are all in this together, and as we want to, on the one hand, we want to make this service more readily available to those families and individuals that really could stand to benefit from this. At the same time, we want to recognize the continued restraints and restrictions that the squeeze that counties are feeling.
Thank you, Senator Lynch. Any further questions on the amendment? Senator Lynch, you want to move your amendment?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move adoption of the A2 amendment as amended.
Any further discussion on the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, then I'd like to request that Senate File 481 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. It has some very small administrative costs attached to it. So.
Okay. Any further discussion on Senator Berglund's bill? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Next, we'll take Senate File 3029. This is the Advocating Change Together. Senator Berglund, whenever you're ready.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the division, this bill is a bill that I've introduced that would help Advocating Change Together be able to seek a federal match for the grant that they get from the state. Now, the grant they get from the state's been cut back, but there are still some state funds that they do receive, and it would be helpful to them if they could get federal match to help cushion the reduction in state funds that they have received. I have with me today Mr. Cardenas to testify on the bill.
Mr. Cardenas, welcome to the committee.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is thank you. This is a piece of legislation that is not an amendment. However, last year when we had the bill to transfer the funds, somehow this language about seeking the federal funds, although we testified for that in each the House and the Senate, when it reached DHS, it no longer had that federal match language in it. So we don't know where it went. And then conversations with Mr. Gill, we came up with this as a new bill to add to that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cardenas. Are there questions from the committee? Okay. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, if there's no questions, then I would move that Senate File 3029 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to just make an oral amendment, if it's okay with Senator Berglund, to put in on lines probably 10, the ranking minority members should be notified also.
That's fine.
Council will make that oral amendment. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 3029 as amended be recommended to pass.
I think we have to vote on the amendment.
I'm sorry.
On the Rosen
oral amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. With that, Senator Berglund will move Senate File 3029 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
3029
has been adopted. Next, we'll move on to Senate File 3259. Senator Berglund, whenever you're ready.
Chair and members of the committee, this is a bill that proposes to increase the CFMR license surcharge. And it would be mechanism for drawing down some more federal funds off of our ICFMR program in order to help balance our budget without having to further hurt group homes by reducing their rates. And we have a payback mechanism in the bill, increasing the rates to $8.74 a day to help make sure that this, the half of the fee that is being provided for us to get the federal match would come back to the facilities. This isn't always exactly perfect, but it isn't too bad in terms of the impact that it has on facilities. We do have a fiscal note that shows the savings to the state of being just over a little over $3 million.
Questions from the committee?
Bruce Nelson is here.
Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you, and members of the division. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM, and we represent most of the ICFMR providers in Minnesota. Back in, I think it was 2003, ARM brought a similar measure forward to this division to try to help be part of the solution then, and that year's deficit. We didn't realize there was more that could be done. And so when Senator Berglund called us into the office last week, we're happy that we can, again, be part of the solution to this year's budget deficit. It does create a few losers, and Senator Berglund is committed to working with us to see if we can even that out a little bit. But still maintain the savings to the state. So ARM fully supports this bill, and we're very pleased that we can, again, be part of the solution.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Nelson, what do you have to do to be a loser? What's the criteria to be a loser?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the payout difference. So you pay the surcharge, and you get a share of the federal money back. It's based on 95% occupancy. So the surcharge is based on licensed beds, all of the beds that the ICFMR has. And so if you drop below 95% overall for the year in occupancy, you pay out more than you get back. And that is the same situation that happened before, but it was a reasonable thing to do in light of the deficit that year and in the overall scheme of things of trying to find resolution to keeping providers whole and to solve the state budget problem.
That Madam Chair, I think
Senator Berglund.
I think in cases where facilities drop below 95% occupancy, it's usually for a temporary period of time. It's not something they can't remedy. So occasionally this will happen, but a rate decrease is permanent and happens every day of the week when you have to do that to people. So this doesn't, of course, get us the entire amount that the governor had slated for a second round or a second year of rate decreases to group homes and other long-term care providers, but it helps. So we just keep working toward trying to not have to make that cut if we don't have to.
Any further discussion? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 8916 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Berglund, I have Senate File 3259.
I'm sorry.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion's adopted.
Thank you very much, members.
That concludes our agenda for today. We will meet again tomorrow on Friday, 8:30 in 107. Meeting's adjourned.
That's funny. I'll be by the weekend.